Well, in 2 days, we are celebrating Sri Radhastami. Does anyone know what Radhastami is? Yes, tell us.
I'm so excited. It's Radharani's appearance day.
Yes.
I think Astami means half of the moon, so it should be, I'm not sure, maybe I have it wrong.
You're pretty close. Yeah, Astami means the eighth day of the month.
Oh, okay.
So there's Janmashtami, that's Krishna Janmashtami, that's Krishna's appearance day. And now, 15 days later, we're approaching Radhastami, which is Srimati Radharani's appearance day. And so I thought I'll read a little about Srimati Radharani in preparation. So this verse, well, we'll read from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 2, Chapter 3. Pure devotional service. Please repeat after me. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
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 So please repeat. Jivan,
Jivan.
Shava,
Shava.
Bhagavata,
Bhagavata.
Angri,
Angri.
Renum,
Renum.
Na,
Na.
Jatu,
Jatu.
Martya,
Martya.
Abhilabheta,
Abhilabheta.
Ya,
Ya.
Tu, Shri,
Shri.
Vishnupadya,
Vishnupadya.
Manuja,
Manuja.
Tulasya,
Tulasya.
Shvasan,
Shvasan.
Shava,
Shava.
Ya,
Ya.
Tu,
Tu.
Na,
Na.
Veda,
Veda.
Gandam,
Gandam.
So see if you can follow. Otherwise, I'll just read the verse twice. Jivan chavo bhagavatam grirenum na jatu martyo bilabeta yastu Shri Vishnupadya manujastu lasya Shvasan chavo yastu na veda gandam Jivan chavo bhagavatam grirenum na jatu martyo bilabeta yastu Shri Vishnupadya manujastu lasya Svasan Chavoyas Tunaveda Gandam. Please repeat. Jivan.
Jivan.
While living.
While living.
Shava.
Shava.
A dead body.
A dead body.
Bhagavat Angri Renum.
Bhagavat Angri Renum.
The dust of the feet of a pure devotee.
The dust of the feet of a pure devotee.
Na.
Na.
Never.
Never.
Jatu.
Jatu.
At any time.
At any time.
Martya.
Martya.
Mortal.
Mortal.
Abhilabheta.
Abhilabheta.
Particularly received.
Particularly received.
Ya.
Yeah.
A person.
A person.
To.
To.
But.
But.
Shri.
Shri.
With opulence.
With opulence.
Vishnupadya.
Vishnupadya.
Of the lotus feet of Vishnu.
Of the lotus feet of Vishnu.
Manuja.
Manuja.
A descendant of Manu.
A descendant of Manu.
A man. Tulasya.
Tulasya.
Leaves of the tulsi tree.
Leaves of the tulsi tree.
Shvasan.
Shvasan.
While breathing.
While breathing.
Shava.
Shava.
A dead body.
A dead body.
Ya.
Ya.
Who.
Who.
To.
To.
But.
But.
Naveda.
Naveda.
Never experienced.
Never experienced.
Gandam.
Gandam.
The aroma.
The aroma.
Translation by Srila Prabhupada. Jai Srila Prabhupada. Ki jai. The person who has not at any time received the dust of the feet of the Lord's pure devotee upon his head is certainly a dead body. And the person who has never experienced the aroma of the tulsi leaves from the lotus feet of the Lord is also a dead body, although breathing. Please repeat. A person who has not
at any time,
received
the dust
of the feet of the Lord's pure devotee,
the feet of the Lord's pure devotee
upon his head,
is certainly a dead body.
And the person who has never experienced the aroma of the tulsi leaves,
the aroma of the tulsi leaves
from the lotus feet of the Lord,
from the lotus feet of the Lord
is also a dead body,
also a dead body,
although breathing.
Although breathing.
Purport by Srila Prabhupada. According to Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, the breathing dead body is a ghost. When a man dies, he is called dead. But when he again appears in a subtle form, not visible to our present vision, and yet acts, such a dead body is called a ghost. Ghosts are always bad elements, always creating a fearful situation for others. So, according to the Bhagavad Gita, the living entity is a spiritual particle. Lord Krishna explains that he has two energies, the para-prakriti, or superior energy, which is spiritual, and the apara-prakriti, or inferior energy, which is material. And the material elements are divided into six, Bhumir Apu Valo Nayor Kamano Buddha Evacha. Earth, water, fire, air, ether. Those are the gross material elements. And then mind, intelligence, and ego, or false ego. Those are three subtle elements. And then there's the spiritual energy. So we, as living beings, are spirit souls, atma, or jivatma. And we have this gross physical body made of earth, water, fire, or as in modern language, more like, you know, solids, liquids, gases. And then a subtle body, mind, intelligence, and ego. So when the soul leaves the body at the time of death, it leaves behind the gross body, but it retains the subtle body, and according to one's activities in life and one's consciousness at the time of death, one gets the next body. And in rare cases, a person will not get a gross body, but will have only a subtle body. Those living entities who have only a subtle body and not a gross body are called ghosts. So how does one become a ghost? The most common way, not that I'm advising this as a technique, I'm rather advising it as something to avoid, is suicide. Because by committing suicide, in effect, one is saying he or she does not want a gross body. But they will have a subtle body. The subtle body always accompanies the spirit soul. And ghosts are always tormented because they have gross material desires. And that's why they committed suicide, because they have gross material desires that were frustrated. So having only a subtle body, but having gross material desires, but not having a gross body through which to fulfill them, is a very frustrating situation. There was once a movie, and I'm not recommending that you see it, called Ghost. And I heard about it as a devotee. I didn't see movies. But I heard about it as a devotee, and some devotees were conjecturing that the author of the movie had read Srimad Bhagavatam, because so much of the philosophy of Srimad Bhagavatam was accurately portrayed in the film Ghosts. And as destiny would have it, that movie played as in, now it's different, but it's in you know, some decades ago, they would have in-flight movies and they'd show it on a screen and everyone would watch it, you know. So I got the chance to see it. And it was actually quite an accurate depiction of the frustrations of ghosts. Like, I don't remember much from the film, but I do remember the ghost was on the platform of a train station and he wanted to have a cigarette and there was like a vending machine and he's like, but he didn't have a gross body, he didn't have any money, like banging on the vending machine so he could get a cigarette. But he couldn't. So ghosts have gross material desires. They don't have a gross physical body. But they need a gross physical body to fulfill their desires. And so they try to possess the body of someone else. So they can, you know, enjoy through that person's body. So they, and it happens, I know, you can like, feel it when you're being attacked by a ghost. And the best thing to do is to chant Hare Krishna loudly, and then they'll go away. And that is it's not only the best way to get rid of ghosts, but it's also the best way to help them. Mm. Now, another way someone can take birth as a ghost is to be very attached to, like, there, you know, stories of haunted castles. So, you know, the occupant of the castle is very attached to that castle. So at the time of death, he thinks of the castle. But he can't take birth as a castle because that's not a form of life. But he can take birth as a ghost in that castle and continue to live in that castle that he was so absorbed in that even at the time of death he was thinking of it. And so there's a lot of stories of haunted castles. And sometimes it happens that, you know, a nice property will be haunted, and therefore the owner of the property can't get a good price for it. And so our spiritual master, Srila Prabhupada, said we can buy those properties at a very low rate and chant Hare Krishna, and all the ghosts will leave and we'll have a good temple for Krishna. So that's ghosts. Now, so I'll continue reading the purport here by Srila Prabhupada. So, ghosts are always very bad elements, always creating a fearful situation for others. Similarly, the ghost-like non-devotees who have no respect for the pure devotees nor for the Vishnu deity in the temple create a fearful situation for the devotees at all times. The Lord never accepts any offering by such impure ghosts. Now, by nature, we are all servants of Krishna. Jiva Swarupai Krishna Nityadas, the constitutional position of the soul or the living entity is to be an eternal servant of Krishna. That's our actual nature, identity. So when a ghost, you know, ghosts can, you know, apart from completely taking possession of your body, can influence your thinking. Like one devotee said to Srila Prabhupada, sometimes he has these, you know, thoughts pass through his mind that he would never think in his normal consciousness. And Srila Prabhupada said, well, it could be a ghost, you know, who's temporarily influencing his thinking. So the reason a non-devotee is compared to a ghost is because in our right consciousness, our normal consciousness, we are in the mood of service to Krishna. But if we're not in the mood of service to Krishna, it means we're being influenced by some other consciousness, which is like, you know, being haunted by a ghost. So, the Lord never accepts any offerings by such impure ghosts. In other words, the Lord doesn't really need anything. He's perfect and complete in himself. What he does appreciate is the love and devotion with which something is offered to him. And because these, you know, ghosts like non-devotees have no love and devotion, so he won't accept any offering from them. Now, we come to the next point. There is a common saying that one should first love the dog of the beloved before one shows any loving sentiments for the beloved. They're saying, love me, love my dog. The stage of pure devotion is attained by sincerely serving a pure devotee of the Lord. In other words, the devotee is like the Lord's dog. So, yeah. So the first condition of devotional service to the Lord is to be a servant of a pure devotee. And this condition is fulfilled by the statement, reception of the dust of the lotus feet of a pure devotee who has served another pure devotee. That is the way of pure disciplic succession or devotional parampara. So, one cannot serve the Lord directly. One serves the Lord's devotee who is engaged in the Lord's service. But that devotee has served another pure devotee. And that pure devotee has served another pure devotee. So that is parampara. Parampara literally means one after the other, or disciplic succession. So, say in our case, I served Srila Prabhupada. Then he served his spiritual master, Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Sarasvati Thakur. Then he served his spiritual master, Srila Gaurakishore Das Bhakti. And in that way, all the way back to Krishna, who's the original spiritual master. So service is rendered to Krishna through the parampara, and knowledge is received from Krishna through the parampara. I received knowledge from my spiritual master, Srila Prabhupada, which he received from his spiritual master, which he received from his spiritual master, and so on, back to Krishna, who's the original spiritual master. That is the way of pure disciplic succession or devotional parampara. Maharaj Rahugana, who's a king, inquired from the great saint Judd Bharat as to how he had attained such a liberated stage of a Paramahansa. It's like the highest stage of devotional service. And in answer, the great saint replied as follows. Srimad Bhagavatam 5.12.12. Rahuganai tat tapasanayati na chejaya nirvapanad grihadva na chandasa naiva jalagni suryair vina mahat padarajo bishekam. O King Rahugana, the perfectional stage of devotional service, or the Paramahansa stage of life, cannot be attained unless one is blessed by the dust of the feet of great devotees. It is never attained by tapasya, austerity, the Vedic worshipping process, acceptance of the renounced order of life, the discharge of the duties of household life, the chanting of the Vedic hymns, or the performance of penances in the hot sun, within cold water, or before the blazing fire. In other words, the perfectional stage of devotional service cannot be achieved by any of those worthy activities, but it can be attained only by being blessed by the dust of the feet of great devotees. And the word is Mahat. Mahat means great devotee. Pada means foot. Raja means dust. And Abhishekam. Abhishek means like a bathing ceremony. Where you bathe yourself in the dust of the lotus feet of a pure devotee. And that is a qualification for advancing in Bhakti Yoga. But what does that mean? Well, generally, accepting the dust of the lotus feet of the pure devotee means to follow the instructions of the pure devotee, to serve the pure devotee, which means to follow the instructions of the pure devotee. In other words, Lord Sri Krishna is the property of his pure, unconditional devotees, and as such, only the devotees can deliver Krishna to another devotee. Krishna is never obtainable directly. Lord Chaitanya therefore designated himself as Gopi Bhartu Padakamalayor Dasa Das Anudasa, or the most obedient servant of the servants of the Lord, who maintains the Gopi damsels at Vrindavan. A pure devotee, therefore, never approaches the Lord directly, but tries to please the servant of the Lord's servants. And thus the Lord becomes pleased. And only then can the devotee relish the taste of the tulsi leaves stuck to his lotus feet. In the Brahma Samhita, it is said that the Lord is never to be found by becoming a great scholar of the Vedic literature, but he is very easily approachable through his pure devotees. So the Sanskrit is Vedeshu Durlabham. Vedeshu means to the Vedas. Durlab means difficult. Difficult to attain. Vedeshu Durlabham. Adurlabham Atmabhakta. Very easy to approach through his devotee bhakta. In Vrindavan, Vrindavan is a holy place in India, which is where Krishna appeared and manifested his childhood pastimes. And most beloved pastimes of Krishna, like if you've ever been in the temple room here, Radhakala Chandri's temple, there are paintings on the wall of Krishna's pastimes. And all those pastimes took place, or take place, because they're eternal, all those pastimes took place in Vrindavan. And the Vrindavan on earth, which appears to be a holy place in India, is actually a replica or a descent of the original Vrindavan in the spiritual world. So this is also very mysterious, but the Vrindavan on earth is not an ordinary place. It is actually not different from the spiritual Vrindavan in the spiritual sky. And Srila Prabhupada gives the example of an embassy. An embassy is not actually in the country where it's located, but it's actually considered an extension of the country that it's from. So Vrindavan, the Vrindavan on earth, is like the embassy of Krishna in the spiritual world, and it's also spiritual, just like the Goloka Vrindavan or Krishna Loka. But devotees of Krishna go to the Vrindavan on earth because it's a very favorable environment for advancing in bhakti yoga, in Krishna consciousness. And so we can learn a lot from the modes of worship in Vrindavan. In Vrindavan, all the pure devotees pray for the mercy of Srimati Radharani, the pleasure potency of Lord Krishna. Srimati Radharani is a tender-hearted feminine counterpart of the Supreme Whole, resembling the perfectional stage of the worldly feminine nature. So the complete conception of Godhead, like sometimes people ask, you know, do you consider God to be male? Well, we do. But male and female. like our worshipable deity, as you can see in the temple, is Radha and Krishna, both male and female. And although they're both divine, and Krishna is very merciful, but even more merciful than Krishna is Srimati Radharani. And therefore devotees approach her first. And through her it's easier to approach Krishna. In Vrindavan, all the pure devotees pray for the mercy of Srimati Radharani, the pleasure potency. Potency means like energy, and pleasure potency means she gives pleasure to Krishna. The pleasure potency of Lord Krishna. Srimati Radharani is a tender-hearted, feminine counterpart of the Supreme Whole, resembling the perfectional stage of the worldly feminine nature. Therefore, the mercy of Radharani is available very readily to the sincere devotees. And once she recommends such a devotee to Lord Krishna, the Lord at once accepts the devotee's admittance into his association. So Srimati Radharani is Mahabhagavata. It's like the highest level of devotee. And the nature of Mahabhagavats is that they see that everyone is serving Krishna except themselves. Everyone's a better servant than they are. And so Radharani is like that. She said, oh, Krishna, see that devotee? That devotee is better than I am. You should accept that devotee. And if she recommends someone, then Krishna will accept. Within the larger area of Vrindavan, or Vraja, there are different, you could say, well, neighborhoods, like in Dallas, there are so many neighborhoods. So, one of the neighborhoods is Varshana, and that's where Srimati Radharani appeared and had her early pastime. So there's a saying in Varshana, and there's a little, you could say, transcendental rivalry there. And there's a saying in Varshana that whatever Radha likes, Krishna does. So if Radha, you know, likes that Krishna should accept someone, Krishna will accept. So whatever Radha likes, Krishna does. And whatever Radha does, Krishna likes. The conclusion is, therefore, that one should be more serious about seeking the mercy of the devotee than that of the Lord directly. And by one's doing so, by the goodwill of the devotee, the natural attraction for the service of the Lord will be revived. That attraction is there, but it's been covered over by our material association. But it can be revived by spiritual association, by the association of devotees, pure devotees. Hare Krishna. So are there any questions or comments? Chaitanya Chandra Prabhu, would you like to say something?
First part, in terms of understanding the taking of another birth and not being embodied anymore. So what is the recommendation for us to try to have some kind of control over what we're going to take birth of as the next life? That seems very like it's a really big, it's a very broad like possibilities of where we could possibly take our birth. So that's one description is like, we may not get a body, a physical body, we may get some stuck in our soul body. So what is the recommendation for trying to at least get an improved version of what we got now, or, you know?
Yes, that's a very important question. In the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, yam yam vapi smaram bhavam, that whatever you think of at the time of death, that will determine your next life. So our goal is to think of Krishna, because if we think of Krishna at the time of death, then we'll go to Krishna. And then we no longer have to suffer, you know, the repetition of birth, death, old age, and disease. And that is called the final exam. Death is the final exam. Because whatever, there's like a saying in Indian language, sadan karo bhajan karo, that whatever devotional practices you do in your life will be tested at the time of death. So we're all like preparing ourselves for the time of death, because that's critical. That will determine our next life. So if we can think of Krishna at the time of death, then we'll go to Krishna. You don't have to take birth again in the miserable material world. But you still exist. You have a spiritual form like Krishna's, and you enjoy with Krishna. It's not like you merge and become one. And like, that's why a lot of people don't want to be liberated, because they think liberation means you merge and become one with some void or some light, and then there's no enjoyment.
Can I ask a question?
Yes, please.
How does one ensure that they think of Krishna at the time of death? Let's say you have an illness or a neurological something that is going on. Is it a process where during your lifetime before you become ill, you associate with other devotees? And therefore, maybe perhaps they will be with you at the time of death.
Or and therefore, what?
Perhaps they'll be with you at
the
time of death.
Yeah. So practice. It's like a final exam. You attend the classes. You do your assigned reading. You get pop quizzes. And they'll sort of show you where you're at and where you have to improve. And yes, we ideally we would be surrounded by devotees at the time of death, and they would be chanting and helping us focus on Krishna, focus on hear the holy name of Krishna. Yeah, and having a, you know, like some neurological condition doesn't really, on a certain level it can impede the control one has over one's thoughts, but on a deeper level, you know, if you're attached to Krishna, then, you know, you'll think of him. that's the thing. Like, if you love someone, then you naturally think of that person. So our process, bhakti yoga, is to develop love for Krishna, and then when we love Krishna, then naturally we think of him. But it also works the other way, that by practicing thinking of him, you know, hearing about him, chanting his name, that also helps us revive that dormant love. But yes, association of devotees is very important. Very important.
Well, actually, I had a part two on that one.
Okay.
Because I just came from El Paso.
Wait, let me just add one more thing to this. So, I've established a hospice in Vrindavan in India. You know what a hospice is? And that's the whole idea. Of course, we do give palliative care, but the real idea is to help those devotees who are in the final stage to think of Krishna at the time of death. That's the whole culmination of the entire effort. Yes?
I was asked when I was there, because just a few weeks ago, somebody gunned down and shot like 50 people and killed 22 of them at the Kmart I shop at when I'm there in El Paso, and some of my friends had relatives there. So somebody, you know, was asking what happens to people when they leave their body in a situation like that, possibly. And I was like, wow, that's a hard one to answer, because there's just a shocking experience for some crazy person when it started shooting people and killing people. So what happens to people at the time of death when it's like that? I was like, really, you know, kind of a hard question they asked me. I wasn't quite sure how to deal with that exactly.
Well, it really depends on the person's consciousness. I mean, we don't know when death will come. And so, however and whenever it does come, we should be prepared. Of course, when it's such a ghastly situation, you know, we don't have the support that we would like to have of loved ones surrounding us, chanting and helping us remember Krishna. So, but if we're surrendered to Krishna, then, you know, however and whenever it comes, we'll be prepared by virtue of our surrender to Krishna.
So according to whoever's, what their relationship with God is, whether they're a Krishna devotee or whether they're, there's just a lot of Catholics and Christians there amongst the people there in El Paso, so according to whatever their relationship with God is.
Yeah, when I say Krishna, I mean God.
They would attain some destination that the Lord will provide for them because of that shocking, quick situation where they didn't have really any time to prepare themselves. They were just executed.
Yeah, it's a test of their God consciousness. Yes.
Excuse me. What about their karma? What about this list that from all these lifetimes ago, there's an account of a king who had all his 100 sons were all killed, and he said, why wasn't even one spared? And please correct me if I'm wrong, but I understood it to say, to him, you had to go through enough lifetimes and have enough karma to get to a king, to have the wife, to have the kids, and 100 kids, so that you could cancel out this debt. It's my understanding, and please help me. I'm trying not to lament in these situations like this, because surely, you know, that plays a part there, karma, and it's unfortunate. It's very unfortunate. I'm not saying that's what you get, you know, like, no way, but where does karma play in these type of situations or, you know, just heinous like this?
Well, you are absolutely right that it was their karma. I mean, unless they're devotees. Devotees are in a different category. But otherwise, it's their karma to have died like that. But even then, they still could remember God. So pure devotional service is like anya vilasita sunyam jnana karma dhyanavritam, that it's not covered by karma. In other words, it's transcendental to karma.
Can you say that one more time?
Pure devotional service is transcendental to karma. So we all come to Krishna consciousness with some karma. But when we surrender to Krishna, then he like takes away all the karma. But there's some details to that. But the principle is he takes it away. Because at the end of the Bhagavad Gita it says, Sarva dharman parityajya mame kam sharanam vraja. Give up all varieties of religiousness and just surrender to me. Aham tvam papebhyo mokshayishyami. I will protect you from all sinful reactions. Hasucha, do not fear. So when we surrender to Krishna, he takes away our sinful reactions. Like the people who were gunned down in that atrocity, they were suffering karmic reactions. And it's sort of like to say mercy is higher than justice. So according to your karma, you may deserve a certain reaction, but if you surrender to Krishna, then by his mercy, you know, he can free you from those. That's what comes when you surrender to Krishna. But there's also one subtle point, and that is that Srila Prabhupada said that Krishna will use the devotee's karma to the devotee's best advantage. In other words, you surrender to Krishna, so he takes away your karma, in a sense. He holds your karma. But it may be beneficial for you to experience something that resembles a karmic reaction to help you give up false attachments to the material world, or like subtle desires to enjoy. So it's not exactly karma, but it resembles karma. Is actually meant for your purification and betterment.
I have a question about when. Do we need to?
I had a question.
Oh, okay. Go ahead.
I had a question. It's a purport from Prabhupada.
Okay.
And so, this is on 10th canto, first chapter. He says, instead of allowing one to forget one's original position, Krishna can revive one's original identity at the time of one's death, even though the mind may be flickering. Although the mind may work imperfectly at the time of death, Krishna gives the devotee shelter at his lotus feet. Therefore, when a devotee gives up his body, the mind does not take him to another body. And then, in relation to that, there's a story of Ramanuja. He had six doubts that he went to his friend who was a pujari, and he said, can you pray to, there was a priest at the temple, he said, can you pray to the Lord to answer my six doubts? And he didn't explain what the doubts were. And then the next day, the priest from the temple said, I got the answers. I don't know what the questions are, but here he came to, the Lord came to me in a dream and he gave me the six answers. And so he gave him these verses. So the fourth and fifth verse, it says, fourth, devotees will certainly be liberated even if by chance they fail to remember me at the time of death. Fifth, as soon as my devotee gives up their present body, I bring them to my supreme abode. And then this is also followed by a verse from the Varaha Purana. And in the verse it says, if my devotee is unable to remember me at the time of death because of disturbance felt within the body at that time, then I shall remember my devotee and take him back to my supreme abode.
Hi. Beautiful. There's another verse in the same vein that says that just like a mother cow can identify her calf in a multitude of calves. Similarly, the Lord will, identify his devotee at the time of death and take them back, reclaim them.
When you say that if one surrenders to Krishna, all of their karma is kind of absolved. Because when I was growing up, I was told by a certain priest, I would ask questions in church, and they would say, all you have to do is accept Jesus Christ as your Savior and you're good. But there was not really a practice that was emphasized, and people, would kind of do all sorts of things, but they would say, oh, I believe in Jesus, so I'm good. So in what way is this different, surrendering to Krishna? What exactly does that mean?
Well, surrendering to Krishna means that you follow his instructions. Like if you're in a fight, you say, I surrender. Oh, okay, what does that mean? Okay, I surrender. Do what you say. So, the idea is that you may have engaged in sinful activities before you surrendered, but after you surrender, then you don't. Whereas in what Srila Prabhupada said about confession. I mean, confession is good, actually. But his criticism of confession was that people go to the church and confess their sins and they get relief. But then they engage in the same sins. And then they go back and confess. So that's not very congenial. Yeah, there's a nice saying, every saint has a past and every sinner has a future. Oh yeah, associate with devotees, surrender to Krishna, and future is bright. Any other questions or comments? Yes, I'd like.
In reading different things about the history of different religions, I find that there's a lot of sort of obscure, different groups of people who have practices, different tribes in South America or in Africa where they worship things that are kind of seem. I can't really figure out whether it's personal or impersonal, like they worship like a river or like worship God in the form of fire and different things like that. And just reading even that Native Americans also have a lot of practices like this where they worship God in these sort of in ways that I can't really tell whether it's personal or impersonal. Because Krishna does say that he takes different forms, as it like Shalagram, Govardhan, and he says that he's the taste of water and different things like that. So when I read those things, that makes sense to me. Hearing that different indigenous people worship rivers and worship fire, for me, I think about different things in the Gita or the Bhagavatam that Krishna says, yes, that he's the taste of water, or he comes in different forms. So I just wanted to like have clarification that me reading that and thinking, oh yeah, that is kind of Krishna conscious. And if they're not thinking of it that way, it might be kind of impersonal. But I just didn't know exactly what to think about it. I thought it was very interesting in just reading it.
So what is your question?
Is that sort of worship personal or impersonal?
Well, it could be either, but the tendency everywhere is to conceive of God as being impersonal, because people are conditioned by the idea that personality means like our personality, which is limited and fraught with so many frailties. So they think, you know, if God is a person, you know, we're limiting him. Of course, it's the opposite, because if you say he can't be a person, you're limiting him. And in a way, he's both, because he does have the impersonal light that comes from his transcendental body, the Brahma Jyoti. But yeah, I think, you know, without the association of devotees, it's very hard to have a personal conception of God. So, yeah.